Hi, you're watching Stefan Levera podcast brought to you by Swan.com. Have you wondered how much it costs to hack a hardware wallet? Today, Dimitri Nodos joins me. Those of you who have been around for a while might have seen the 2018 wallet.fail talk. This is a well-known talk talking about how to hack various well-known hardware wallets at the time. Now, of course, the space has evolved a bit since then, but Dimitri joins me to share some of his expertise in what he's doing. He has a PhD in chip security, and he is doing audits from a security perspective. And so I think he has some interesting perspectives to share on Bitcoin hardware wallets, such as how much it costs to attack, what are some realistic attacks, as well as some ideas on backups and Shamir's secret sharing. So check out this episode with Dimitri. Dimitri, welcome to the show.
Hey, Stefan. Thanks for having me.
So, Dimitri, I know you come from a background of a PhD in chip security, and you were involved back in 2018, I believe it was, the wallet.fail. Thought it'd be interesting to get you on, get your thoughts on Bitcoin hardware security. And I know you've also got a backups project that we'll get into as well. But just for listeners who don't know you, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into all this Bitcoin security stuff.
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Dimitri, better known as Nedos in whatever hacker cryptocurrency circles. So you guys can find me Twitter, Telegram, LinkedIn, whatever. First five letters of my last name, N-E-D-O-S. I did my PhD at TU Berlin in Germany in chip security. I was looking at, you know, the kinds of attacks that you would apply to chips that are coming out nowadays. So think EL6 plus certified smart cards. What kind of attacks could you still try to pull off there? What kind of attacks could you do against something like a modern smartphone SoC and all that kind of stuff? So that was primarily what my PhD focused on. It's a super niche thing. I mean, there's probably, I don't know, I would say less than 100 people in the world that look at chip security at the kind of level that I do. So it's totally a niche market in the sense that there's just not a whole lot of people doing this at a professional level. And right when I was about to finish my PhD, I think it was 2015, 2016 was when the Trezor kickstarted. Somebody with my background, and I was already trying to get in crypto a little bit. I was just immediately triggered, you know, Zoom focused in on this, just completely mind blown that, for all intents and purposes, I mean, the promise of the hardware components, et cetera, that the Trezor was going to use, I thought were going to be a little bit inadequate for storing, you know, millions of dollars of crypto. I mean, I had a lot of conversations back then one of the things you do if you're such a niche professional like I am, over the years, we actually did a lot of white label research where essentially we do research, a company publishes it, quote unquote, as research that they did internally. I mean, I don't have any bad feelings about that, but it's just something that you do. And so I remember going to the office of a company that we were working with at the time, and I was pitching him this idea, like, let's look at all these. I had a bunch of ledgers under one arm, a bunch of Trezors under the other arm. I go to their head office, and I throw them on the table, and I say, let's take a look at them. We're going to find, you know, big issues with all of these. And they were like, I just remember the quote, the kind of the manager, the head making the decision said, who's going to be storing more than a couple $1,000 on these hardware wallets? And I was like, you don't understand. It's going up in price over time. These same people that are putting $1,000 on them today are going to have $100,000, $500,000, $1 million a couple years down the line. And so, I mean, clearly I was proven right over time, but that was definitely one of the things that piqued my interest was just when hardware wallets started coming out, because it's like a very interesting application for the, you know, the unique skill set that I kind of did my PhD in, et cetera.
Yeah. So as you said, the value rose so dramatically, and that is now starting to put Bitcoin security into a new category, right? And if, you know, let's say we're all bullish on Bitcoin. Obviously, I'm bullish on Bitcoin. Right. I presume you are also.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
It's only going to become more important and more valuable for these things to be, you know, for our coin to be secured in a good way. Now, do you want to just provide a little bit of an overview on, you know, where we are today, just generally, like, abstracting away from just Bitcoin security when it comes to, you know, smartphones? And I don't know, there are other, you know, high security applications that are out there.
Right.
Do you mind just spelling out a little bit of where Bitcoin is today versus some of those other applications?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's a, it's kind of a good place to start, I would say. So the, I mean, in general, if you look at kind of, and I think, in passing, I mean, can we let the podcast know you came over and I showed you dumping a Trezor in person?
Yeah, sure, sure.
All right, fine. So, I mean, Stefan can vouch for it. He saw it in person. So I gave him a live demo of a real one going through the ringer, so to say. But if you compare like a cryptocurrency wallet to what you would have, say, I mean, the kind of pinnacle, ironically, over time or in history was smart card security. And there's actually a really good book, which I also I think I mentioned to you, Stefan, is called Murdoch's Pirates, which is basically about the hacking that happened in the 90s and early 2000s, where essentially the different companies doing PTV security, so essentially making the card that you put in your DirecTV receiver to be able to decode, and it's usually like decode the next 5 seconds of TV. That's how often they switch keys for the encoding. The security of this smart card, basically what ended up happening was, like, and it's all detailed in this book, was through shady structures, all of these, all the companies were hacking each other and hiring subsidiaries to hack their competitors, and then leaking the keys of their competitors to pirates and stuff like this. So there, people don't understand that there's already a precedent for, like, as soon as there was, you know, financial billions of dollars or like millions of dollars of financial gain, all the complexity of we have to go to scanning electron microscope or focused ion beam level reverse engineering at a transistor level of these chips, there's already precedence for this having happened before. Completely, you know, not affiliated with the government or anything like that. I mean, the government will be like another thing that's coming into the purview, so to say, right now. I mean, I think I mentioned to you that the IRS had essentially a tender for companies to recover cryptocurrency wallets that I'm a little bit shocked that more people aren't aware of, that they actually had a bidding process where companies were bidding on, you know, claiming that they have the ability to recover cryptocurrency wallets for the IRS, which, I mean, hint, hint, I think that means the IRS has thousands of wallets if they're you know, trying to get a bidding process going. So, I mean, there's kind of these private actors, there's, you know, the public sector, quote unquote, you know, things like the IRS that are going to be funneling money into it. And so the kind of the level of security is night and day when you look at smart cards. You know, there's obfuscation, they do custom chips per customer, they do crazy amounts of lengths that they go to. And so everything that you'll see in cryptocurrency, it's very much, you know, open source, general purpose, which I'm a huge fan of, you know, the open source part of it, you know, the community coming together to build these things. But there's just a gigantic gap at the level of security that's been achieved in essentially other industries and the kind of security that you would see on, you know, most hardware, the popular hardware wallets today. I mean, I have to admit that we also, one thing that I forgot to mention is after we did our talk, I mean, we should get into the talk as well and some of the feedback. I mean, I just remember for a long time I wasn't doing any public interviews or anything just because of the outrage on Reddit on all sides at our talk. It just took a little bit of time to let that all sink in and kind of feel that you know, you can go back to the opinion that you previously held on a lot of these things and continue the discussion. Yeah. But
let's talk about, you know, the different types of devices and kind of
right.
Where,
so I mean, you know, I mean, in terms of devices that you would see in crypto, I mean, the basically, I would say the summary is, I mean, you have these hardware wallets that are, you know, sort of general purpose devices, sort of. I mean, I usually summarize it as you know, USB stick slash encrypted USB stick level of security. There's some companies that use like a true smart card based chip. I mean, so you could argue, you know, that's, for example, Ledger on the Nano S used essentially a smart card based secure element. The one that gets used by a lot of companies is actually the microchip ATECC608. And there's also like the Maxim, I mean, both of which are on the cold card, for example. I mean, those are technically, I would call them authentication ICs if I want to be really picky, because they're not actually executing any code. So for me, that's like an important line, whether this thing has code running on it or it's just some sort of state machine. And then actually when you get into crypto for backend stuff, I mean, I know you're affiliated with to a degree with Swan, for example. So somebody like Swan is probably running a hardware security module, an HSM, on the backend, where essentially in a separate environment, they're running and signing and doing all this stuff. So, I mean, there's issues with every single one of those. I mean, maybe the most obvious ones, if we're starting from the kind of from the tail end in the HSMs, I mean, a lot of the crypto that gets used in cryptocurrency, I mean, I know we're primarily talking about Bitcoin on your podcast, but especially if you go, you know, into anything outside of Bitcoin, it's kind of, I always say it's like the cyberpunk or the cypherpunk dream cryptocurrency, because it's essentially the, you know, you'll have a process in which the next algorithm gets selected, and the number two algorithm, so the number one loser is the one that gets picked for a lot of cryptocurrencies, which, I mean, that's not to denigrate that algorithm in any way, but what ends up happening is that algorithm didn't make it in a certification, and that means that out of the box HSM doesn't support it. So when we're talking about HSMs, a gigantic problem is how much of the cryptography that has to happen to support the cryptocurrency is actually happening on the HSM versus, you know, being written as custom third-party libraries that no one ever looked at and then running on the HSM, at which point it's a question of, you know, what's the tangible security benefit from having an HSM at all, for example. So, I mean, we have this argument with a lot of consulting clients, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, that's the kind of the HSM example. Yeah, go ahead.
Gotcha. So when you mentioned the curve, like, are you referring there to like libsecp 256k1 or what? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it really depends, because I do have to say, like, it fluctuates, and some will get included into different certifications, and some, you know, chips will include them anyway, but there's a lot of, I mean, for example, the curve, they use a different curve. That's it. Game over. If the curve's not included, it's not running in the hardware, so to say. If it's not running in the hardware, I mean, can you claim that, you know, this hardware security module that's supposed to be doing all the crypto and hardware is, you know, fulfilling its promises to you as the, you know, the integrator who's using this HSM in their backend? And so I would say it's, you know, questionable. Click on doubt.
Yeah. Okay. And so just, I guess, just to close up the loop on the different device types. So you mentioned like the pay TV example of like being a very high level of security, at least compared to what's out there today. Where would you put, you know, smartphones? Like Google has the, you know, Pixel, the Titan chip, or Samsung, you know, there's different smartphone level of security. Where would you put that?
I mean, another metric that I often use. So, I mean, so before the pandemic, one of the things that we would do is we would fly to companies, give trainings. I mean, so for example, I did a training for the, essentially the Android slash Titan team at Google 1 year, just before the pandemic. I mean, I've been at companies like Airbus, at their facility in Toulouse, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, a good metric is how many security engineers do these people, do these companies have working on something? And you will find that somebody like, you know, a Titan team or something along those lines has, you know, for sure, especially compared to a smaller hardware wallet manufacturer, I mean, they will have more security engineers just on the security chip. They probably have, you know, tens of people working in security in total, but they probably have more people working on the essentially the secure element portion of it, the Titan chip or something like this, than a hardware model manufacturer has engineers. So, I mean, I think the people that, you know, just rubber stamp and say that you can't trust a smartphone or a mobile phone, you know, just flat out, you can't trust it. It can't be trusted because, you know, you can use it for surfing inappropriate websites or stuff like this. They're kind of missing the forest from the trees. I mean, I think you can get pretty far in terms of overall security. You know, if you have, for example, a separate smartphone that you just have offline the entire time.
I see. Yeah. And so how much, so, I mean, in the, let's say, Bitcoin security world, actually, before we get into that, let's discuss a little bit about the wallet.fail stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is kind of, I guess, this is maybe your public entry into the world of Bitcoin security. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about what happened there and sort of, you know, back in 2018, I believe it was, and then sort of where things are at now?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, I remember I was actually when you were in Dubai, I was in Dubai, and I wanted to meet up with you, and I went back to my Twitter DMs. I saw you. You sent us a message just after we did the talk, and you're like, I have 7,000 followers on Twitter back in the day. So, I mean, a long time ago. But yeah, no, it was pretty crazy. I mean, for us, it was great. I mean, ever since then, we've been essentially auditing every wallet. I mean, so that totally, it did put us on the map. I mean, people totally find us. I mean, people who want an external audit of their hardware wallet or their, you know, crypto backend, they come to us. We help them out. I mean, we're probably the leader. I mean, we're probably looked at the most wallets out of anyone in the world, just the amount of audits that we do. Not all of them get published, by the way. I mean, because people ask us, like, you only have, you know, a handful of public audits. We do a lot of private ones as well. But yeah, I mean, the talk itself, I mean, we did the talk. I mean, I, you know, like there was a lot of things being said, you know, about us, personally, et cetera. I was a little bit blown away because, you know, as somebody from the information security infosec scene, you know, it was objectively a good talk. I still get fist bumps from, everyone who saw that talk, back in the day. But, a lot of people in crypto, took it as like some personal thing that we had some sort of vendetta to go out and publicly shame the hardware wallets, and that totally wasn't it. It was more to start to raise awareness about all these issues just have people be cognizant of the fact that a lot of the things that your hardware wallet says, I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of it is also marketing driven. The words that they pick on their public. On their public pages, et cetera. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to have an independent third party look at these. And I think, I mean, whether it's the issues that we found on the Trezor or the Ledger, I mean, if either the Trezor or the Ledger, you know, had come to us for this kind of, you know, for us to take a look at it, we would have identified all these issues, before the product launch or something along those lines. So, yeah. But I mean, I vividly just remember that we did a talk. There was an incident response post. I mean, Pavel got up he was in the first row to ask the first question, to us in the talk. And so we talked to them after the talk. Ledger wrote this blog post that claimed that we did James Bond movie style hacking of the Ledger, and that none of this transfers into reality, which I have a little bit of a bone to pick with that statement, because it was completely transferable. So for example, there was a big discussion on the part that made me a little bit sad, just in terms of people picking teams in crypto. You know, we did a talk, and so it had the Ledger and the Trezor, and we showed vulnerabilities in both, which were, you know, pretty big issues. And then the Trezor Reddit was like, can you believe these issues in Ledger? And the Ledger Reddit was like, can you believe these issues in Trezor? And it's like, guys, the talk was about hardware wallets in general and the issues that creep up from using a hardware wallet and blindly trusting it and all this kind of stuff. And then, it was totally lost. It totally turned into, you know, team white or team black. I don't know what color you pick versus team blue. But at the time, at least, I think Ledger had a blue logo back then. I guess Trezor would be green, but they were totally bashing bashing each other on Reddit and totally missing the overall point of the talk, which was, you know, I mean, the kind of the overall point of the talk was the hardware wallets were designed primarily, like, the feature that all of them absolutely tick the checkbox for is they protect you from your computer getting infected with malware and it's sending all the crypto. That's absolutely the issue that all of them solve 100%. But to claim that this is the best way, you know, from now until eternity to have your funds on, it really depends on your use case. It really depends on how you're storing it, where you're storing it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess the next question would be, you know, from 2018 to here we are today, April 2024, how much improvement has there been? Like, how far have hardware wallets come in that time?
Well, I think a lot of hardware, I mean, so Trezor just launched their Trezor that does have a secure element. I mean, again, waiting. I mean, we'd be more than happy if, you know, if Trezor came to us for a public audit for our feedback on it. I mean, I haven't had a chance to get my hands on it. I know that I know the kind of SE they're using. You really have to dive into the details. I mean, I can say that for the previous Trezors that don't have a secure element, what ends up happening is you can essentially dump all of the, I mean, essentially the demo that I, that
right,
we
this
did
is what you showed
together.
Me. Yeah,
so
just for the listeners, so, if you could explain.
Yeah, yeah. Just for the listeners, I mean, what you can do with a Trezor is you can read out all of its contents. Everything is stored on the only chip that is on the Trezor, which is a STM32. You can read out all the contents. Then when you have a snapshot of this on your, you know, like, so the one change that they did after the wall of fail talk is now they encrypt it. But if you try to run, I mean, if you write a script to decrypt this, there's one floating around on the Kraken security blog, just FYI. You can use that script to decrypt the, essentially the, even the encrypted ones. And you're talking about, you know, 10 minutes max to brute force a six-digit PIN. And if we're talking about, I don't know, I mean, 10-digit PIN, all right, fine. It'll take you a day to brute force or something along those lines. But at the end of the day, you recover the seed phrase. And so that's one of the inherent issues with hardware wallets. I mean, the standard way that we see all hardware wallets do it, which is the seed phrase and literally your words are stored on the hardware wallet as is, and they're stored as is because if you use a passphrase, they need to take the words from the seed phrase and add your passphrase on top of it. So they're, for the most part, especially all the hardware wallets that are storing your that let you use a passphrase along with them, they're storing your seed phrase as is, as those words, somewhere in memory on one of the memories on the hardware wallet. So I mean, that's also true for you know, other wallets that do use a secure element. It's just a question of where is it being stored? What's it encrypted by? Is it encrypted by the secure element? Is it just encrypted by the PIN? If it's just encrypted by the PIN, like in the case of Trezor, you're talking about minutes to be able to brute force the passphrase. And I mean, the demo that I gave you was kind of an older Trezor, so everything up to 1.73 wasn't encrypted, so you could just get the seed phrase in plain text, just read it as it appeared on the screen.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the passphrase was the, let's say, supported or chosen mitigation that the Trezor team came out with afterwards. And so then I guess that sort of pushed the ball back one step further, because then it was like, okay, well, now you need to make sure you've got a long passphrase, because otherwise that can get easily brute forced.
Well, I mean, that's actually, I would disagree that that's actually older. That's pre our talk that they came up with this. It's actually so that, I mean, the idea... The OG, I would argue, I mean, I know some people are going to take issue with it, but you can read the BIP on the passphrase. I don't want it, just a disclaimer really quickly. I don't want it to sound like I'm bashing any one of these manufacturers. I think, I mean, you know, you will not believe what devices we've seen, for example, the Trezor crypto library get used in. I mean, you know, let's just say I wouldn't sleep well at night when you see... some of the things that we've seen Trezor crypto running on. I mean, so the Trezor is totally, I mean, the open source approach. They cornered, you know, they were the first. They did it all open source. They're kind of, everyone else is standing on the shoulders of these giants that released it all as open source. Like, they did a huge contribution to the community. It's all out there. Their firmware quality is very good. I constantly refer, you know, whether it's other wallets or other embedded consulting clients, we send them links to commits to code on Trezor Crypto and say, do it like this. Trezor is doing it correctly. The issue is, if the underlying hardware is vulnerable, that doesn't actually help. So to this day, everything that I just described, the issue is not in Trezor. The issue is in the STM32 chip. And so they selected the STM32. The STM32 is vulnerable. You can dump essentially the seed phrase or the encrypted version of the seed phrase, and then you can brute force it, et cetera, online. So it's not technically an issue with our code. That being said, the passphrase, it actually goes back. So I don't remember which BIP it is. Trezor, by the way, Pavel and et al. Are the authors of BIP39. People forget that. So the Trezor founder is the one who submitted BIP39. It got, sucked up into Bitcoin. I don't remember which one adds the passphrase, because I'm pretty sure it's not. I don't think it's BIP30. It might be BIP39. It might be another one that came after it. But essentially, what the idea behind the passphrase was, like, let's say we're going out for, I don't know. Let's say I need to generate a wallet for Stefan, and I want him to not see all the addresses that he's using. So I'll just use my seed phrase. I'll add Stefan on top of it. He'll never be able to figure out what the original seed phrase was, and now I can give him a new address that is only for him and is completely unaffiliated in any way with the seed phrase that I use primarily without revealing it. So that was kind of the intent of it, and it grew, the fact that it grew into like a security mechanism. So originally it was for you to be able to generate, additional seed phrases without,
let's say,
but not just new accounts, essentially, like completely new derivation paths, right, that are in no way affiliated with the original. So I would say to say that is a security feature is a bit of a stretch at best. It wasn't even pitched as kind of a security feature initially. And then, we haven't talked about wallet recovery yet, but that's actually one of the things that there's a lot of vendors doing, where they'll use a GPU farm to essentially brute force your passphrase on top of your. So you send them your, you forgot your passphrase, you send them your BIP39, and they will brute force it for you, and then take usually a percentage of whatever crypto they recover. So they're going to, essentially generate the password, check, is there money on all the addresses that get derived from this path, and then identify the ones that actually have money on them. Because there's no other way to check. You essentially have to spin up a full-blown wallet, look at all the addresses. Is there anything stored there? Oh, okay, this one has money stored there. That must have been a passphrase that this user was using.
Yeah, and listeners, you might be interested. I have an earlier episode with John Cantrell, who spoke about his process of brute forcing. And basically the situation with John Cantrell is, I think somebody had a competition where they were releasing kind of seed words, and I think once it got to maybe seventh or eighth word out of, I can't remember the exact detail, but John Cantrell went and set up like a GPU farm and kind of computed and found the first address and found the money, and he won the coins. It was really interesting story. But I guess coming back to security and how it has evolved, so it seems like, as you're saying, the passphrase was not initially pitched as a security feature, but nowadays there are a lot of people who use it as one, even if it's not was not intended that way.
I there's still a lot of hardware wallets out there that don't support the passphrase, because technically it's in addition to BIP39, I would argue. So, me personally, I don't know all that many people that use a passphrase. I would argue you shouldn't have to use a passphrase. It should be secure as is without the passphrase.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's bring it to, hardware in general, like Bitcoin hardware in general. Like, as you were saying, the main thing that we could say about most of these Bitcoin hardware devices, signing devices or hardware wallets, whatever you want to call them, the idea is that you are separating them from the online connected computer, right? Like, that's where people have this concept of hot wallet and cold wallet. And the idea is that this should theoretically be your cold wallet. And so that's the main thing you were saying that they get right. But the part that maybe, where it's more, that's where some of your work comes into play, is if the attacker has physical access to the device, can they pwn it? And importantly, how much in resources do they need to spend to pwn it? How much time do they need to pwn it? Is that kind of where the debate is?
No, totally. I mean, you nailed it. So, I mean, it's a question of, so I think what a lot of people, and this is like a issue. I mean, I remember going back to even my, I mean, the typical thing, just to give you like an academic hardware security example, the typical calculation that people use, which is flawed for the reasons that we'll discuss here in a second, people use is how much equipment do I need? And then like, let's say that the cost of the equipment is the cost of the attack, but that's not really representative, because if you're running this as a business, I mean, you're going to buy the equipment once, and then it's a question of how many times do you end up, using it. So that's not really a good metric. That being said, I mean, on the Trezor, you're talking about, you know, you can, on the original Trezor/Trezor T, we're talking about, you know, very little hardware. I mean, we train companies to do this kind of testing in-house. Generally, we'll use like an FPGA board. And so that was what I was also showing you, using an FPGA board, which can cost anywhere from, you know, $20 to $100. I mean, you can also, in theory, I mean, some people always give me crap because they're like, you can use a Raspberry Pi Pico, which is like a $10 board. I mean, you could, or I mean, I know the FPGA is going to work, so I usually use the FPGA just because that's my background. But I mean, we're talking about hundreds of dollars to pull off the attack. As soon as you add a secure element, sorry. So if you look, for example, Ledger did a couple publications on, I mean, so this is like another thing which, you know, also, you know, in terms of, you know, I'm glad we don't have a wallet that we're kind of an independent third party. I feel it gives us a little bit more leeway to say this stuff independently. But for example, Ledger has a couple publications at probably the, you know, the biggest, most notable hacker security conference, which is Black Hat in Las Vegas. And they were essentially looking at the 608 kind of with a target in their sights, kind of being the cold card, because that's the secure element that the cold card uses. And I mean, there they were adding essentially, instead of just using voltage glitching, which means you have a power supply and something to turn the power supply on and off really quickly, now you're talking about adding a laser to it. And probably to add the laser to it, now you're talking about at least having, you know, some form of chemical lab or something there to actually open up the chips. And so, I mean, some would argue the calculation there is, what does a chemical lab cost plus what does a laser cost plus what is, you know, the protective eyewear that you have to have in a room while the laser's on cost. You have to add all those up, and then that's the cost of the attack. I think the better price would be to split it into like R&D cost and then incremental cost. A lot of times these, especially when we're talking about, you know, anything having to do with reverse engineered chips or open up chips. I mean, I know at TU Berlin, you know, my alma mater where I did my PhD, I mean, you can rent the lab there. You can just go to the professor, say, hey, we're a private company based in Germany or wherever. We want to come in. Can we rent the lab for a week? And they'll be more than happy, because they're like, sweet, we're going to buy, I don't know, books, or I mean, whatever a university buys, we're going to buy new equipment. Somebody's going to pay for the lab. And a lot of times when you get into really expensive equipment, they're actually extra interested in this, because the more time their equipment's being used, the less time they'll have to spend on calibrating the equipment when it goes out of, because basically by using it, you're making sure that it's working. And so it'll save them time when they want to come back to it. They won't have to be recalibrating every piece of equipment in the lab. So, I mean, I would say it's, I'm a big fan of splitting it into essentially like the R&D man hour cost kind of approach, plus kind of this, you know, like how many hours slash, you know, man hours slash how much lab time is actually required to pull this off. So I would say, you know, if you're talking about the Trezor, I mean, effectively, it's probably, you know, less than $100 worth of effort for pulling off these kinds of attacks. If you're talking about something with a secure element like a 608, you're already in the thousands of dollars. And there, it really depends on the wallet, because, I mean, this is where, I mean, not to toot our own horn too much, but I mean, there's a lot of mistakes that people make in the implementation. So they could be super vulnerable or they could be less vulnerable. And it really has, it's a question of how do they use the secure element, how many chips do they have? Do they have two secure elements? Do they have one secure element? How are they speaking to one another? So it's hard to kind of do a blanket statement there. But most likely, I mean, I would say thousands to tens of thousands of dollars. And then if you're talking about something like the, at some point you kind of reach kind of a top where I would say it's maybe $50,000. So if you have to go into the chip and open it up and do like transistor level modifications, you're talking anywhere from, I mean, that's it. Like at that point, you're, you know, if it's a video game, you turn God mode on, you can do whatever you want to the chip. So, I mean, that's, there's no going beyond that. There you're talking about, you know, 50 to 100,000 per device of effort. However, I mean, to get to that point, the R&D is usually substantial to map out the integrated circuit to figure out where are the vulnerabilities. I mean, where, how does the data move? How can I, you know, dump the data that's on there, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, you can quickly end up on a chip that has no documentation, no open source firmware. What ends up happening is you're just going to spend, you know, potentially many years of R&D to get to the point that you can pull off the attack. So, I mean,
interesting.
I was just going to say, I mean, the open source is great. I mean, and I'm a huge supporter of open source, but people need to understand that at the end of the day, especially in these, especially in the consumer product space, there's a lot of security through obscurity. I mean, if Ledger open sourced everything that they have running on their secure element, which they'll never do because they're obliged by NDA not to ever release that, but I'm sure people would find, serious security vulnerabilities just because you would have another set of eyes looking at this, and it's just somebody coming from a completely different angle, they'd be able to find something.
Back to the show in a moment. This show is brought to you by Swan.com. Swan.com has a mission to onboard millions of people into Bitcoin. And the team have been working really hard to update the Swan Bitcoin app, which you can find in the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store on your phone. So the team has been working really hard to improve that app, make it really fast for people to sign up and be able to buy Bitcoin. So you can go from zero to Bitcoin in just a few minutes. And so this is a really great way to help onboard your friends and family. If you're struggling to get them on board, tell them about Swan. And not just that, Swan is rolling out a new promotion where it's zero fees for your first $10,000 of Bitcoin buys. So you can be standing there with your, you know, with your uncle or whoever, and if they are a no-coiner, you can get them off zero and get them started, and it's zero fees from Swan to buy up to your first $10,000 of Bitcoin. And it's not just for new customers, it's also for existing customers. So make sure you check that out. Send them over to swan.com or, of course, the Swan app in the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store. This show also brought to you by mempool.space. Mempool.space is the leading Bitcoin and blockchain visualizer. Now, as you know, the halving happened and all the degenerates are in the mempool with their runes and inscriptions and things. So mempool.space is an invaluable resource to keep an eye on what's going on. I'm regularly tracking what's happening in mempool.space just so I can see what the fees are like. And of course, whenever I go to send an on-chain transaction, I'm checking mempool.space, and you should too. Mempool.space have a range of dashboards. They've got a lightning dashboard, a mining dashboard. They've even got Liquid. You can also search Bitcoin transactions. There's so many things you can do, and they're rolling out a mempool transaction accelerator, which you can find over at mempool.space/accelerator. And lastly, this show is also brought to you by CoinKite.com, my favorite Bitcoin security hardware creators. Now, they have a range of products. They're most known for the Cold Card. This is the Mark IV. Of course, there are some earlier versions. And their newest product, which is coming out and shipping out to people now, if you pre-ordered, is the Cold Card Q. So it has a lot of the similar features as the Cold Card Mark IV, but it's also got a QR code, and you can use batteries to power it. So that can be really practical. Let's say you've got your device in a far location and you need a way to power it. Well, now you can bring AAA batteries and charge it that way. So the cool thing about these devices is that you can generate your private keys offline, you can keep the device offline, and there's a range of features that you can use, such as multi-signature, to help improve your security level. Now, I wouldn't recommend multi-signature for total beginners. When you're a beginner, I would say just start with a standard hardware wallet, and then over time, you can think about How do I improve my setup over time? Because as my friend NVK, the CEO of CoinKite, says, you've got to secure your Bitcoin like it's worth 10x what it currently is worth, because Bitcoin can move up really quickly. So go to CoinKite.com, make sure you get your gear. That's the cold card. There are various different devices that you can get there. You can even get the metal seed backup plates called the seed plate there. So there's a range of things you can get there. Go to CoinKite.com, use code Levera for a discount. And now back to the show with Dimitri. But it's interesting because, you know, when you talk to IT people and security people, they often say security by obscurity is a bad thing. But in this case, you're sort of saying it almost, in a certain context, it actually raises the cost or makes it harder to hack that particular, to pwn that particular device.
Exactly. And I mean, unfortunately, that's the takeaway of the book that I was mentioning before about the PTV industry. It was all of the, essentially, the security that they got to and the level that they got to and the fact they haven't been hacked has nothing to do. I mean, it has something to do with security, but it's mostly obscurity. I mean, it is like 99% obscurity and 1% security engineering on top of what they were doing. But for the most part, it's obscurity.
Yeah. And when you mention that kind of threshold, let's say the god level or the god tier of 50,000 to 100,000, would you say that's even in the case of those pay TV cards, or would you say that's even higher?
No, so I would say for them, the problems for the pay TV is that the R&D is even exponentially higher than it would be.
It's not
be
just
for
the kind of material cost of the labs and whatever. It's actually the R&D cost would be more prohibitive there on that side.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're, I mean, I know you and I have had this conversation. I mean, another kind of data point that I give people is, and this is like another lesson from the book, is that the book's just a really good documented, you know, copy of all these shenanigans that went on. I mean, I'm surprised some Australian that wanted to some young Australian journalist that wanted to write a book about Rupert Murdoch shenanigans picked this story, because it's a pretty epic one to pick up. The one thing that people also kind of lose sight on is, what's the likelihood of how likely are you to have to reverse engineer that exact chip? Or is there the possibility that I can go and look at another member of the family to essentially get a lot of insight? So, I mean, I would say, I mean, just as an example for the purposes of the discussion, everything that you can do on the STM32 carries over to all the members of the STM32 family. Because at the end of the day, they're based on the same ARM Cortex M cores. They have the same kind of, you know, circuitry that handles them booting up, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are differences between them, but they're still members of the same family. They walk like a duck and quack like a duck. They're a duck for the most part.
Gotcha.
And so you could say the same thing for a lot of the secure, I mean, a lot of the higher end secure elements. So again, for me, secure element, I get for cryptocurrency wallet marketing purposes, calling the authentication chips that a lot of them use a secure element. I mean, I won't completely fault them for it. I just, for the purposes of my technical discussion, for me, a secure element is always something that executes code. So it has to be essentially a smart card-esque device that executes code. Otherwise, I would call it authentication IC, because then for me, that wording implies that it does not execute code. If you're talking about a device that executes code, a lot of for example, the chip that actually gets used on the ledgers, the security chip that they used, at least on the Nano S, I know for a fact, also gets used in printer cartridges. And so printer cartridges, there are, you know, printer cartridges based on this chip where you can go on Amazon and you can buy essentially a compatible printer cartridge chip. Where the original had so the printer cartridge is essentially authenticating itself to the printer as being authentic. And so there are printer cartridges that use the same family of chip that Ledger uses. And so the question is, if you went to China, if you can go on Amazon and buy a cheap printer cartridge, that means that somebody in China hacked that security chip and dumped all of its contents and was able to write from scratch essentially compatible firmware. So now the question is, can I go to China and figure out who did the work? Would they be willing to share this information with me to save me a ton of R&D and essentially get to from point A to point B in a fraction of the time and for a fraction of the cost? Because we're not, you know, me as an outsider looking at cryptocurrency wallets, I'm not trying to encroach on their boondoggle on HP printer cartridges.
Okay. And so I guess one other, practical consideration, thinking back to my conversations with someone like Michael Flaxman, he would sort of explain it like, okay, well, what you can do in practice is use multi-signature, keep the devices in different locations, use different device types such that you are, you know, for securing serious amount of coin, that way you're sort of really making it hard for an attacker, because now they've got to, you know, get you in one place, take you to another place, get that other device, find a way to hack that particular different device. So what are your thoughts on that as an approach of using different devices and in a multi-signature configuration?
So it totally, multi-sig totally solves this for the most part. I mean, I would argue, you know, how many of the wallet manufacturers are pushing multi-sig? I think that's like because it is a solution, but I don't think, from the wallet manufacturer point of view, they would claim, you know, the wallet is secure as a single device, you shouldn't worry about it, et cetera. But I agree. Either by physically separating the key material or requiring you to sign with multiple keys, this solves the issue. At that point you can, I'm a huge fan of the stuff that Swan does. There's other companies as well that do similar multi-sig stuff. It can be a problem. I can tell you that, so maybe we can talk a little bit about recovery as well. Naming this story, we actually, without going into all the background, we actually helped a client who was using multi-sig and ended up in the situation that he had a ledger and a Trezor and used the same pin on both and forgot the pin. And so now the question was, you know, he has a backup provider, a non-custodial multi-sig provider that can vouch for him, but he wants to recover his crypto, and now he needs help with it because he used the same pin. He forgot his pin. He used the long pin. He can't do anything. And so now the question is, what do you do? And so the answer was, in this case, we helped him dump the Trezor, and then he got his multi-sig back. Or essentially got the seed phrase, which was enough to access his multi-sig, which was enough to access his funds. So, all of that is to say, all of these are trade-offs and kind of benefits and all that kind of stuff. Another case, similar one that I heard about recently from a company that, you know, recently I got in touch with. Was that they actually had a case where they had an estate attorney contact them. And the case there was that they had essentially a Ledger Blue that was end of life. And so now they just can't, they have this Ledger Blue, they know the pin and the passphrase and everything, but they cannot access the funds because it's been end of life. And Ledger just doesn't have any support for this anymore. And so the question was, what does somebody like that do? So, the one, you know, argument that I'll make and kind of, I think people should be aware of is, implicit. So I have to say, with the cold card and with, for example, the Trezor, the fact that they actually provide libraries for you to use them completely offline is a huge benefit, where, you know, you can do command line, send the transaction, get the signature, etc. I have more confidence in those devices. But essentially, if you're buying a wallet, to a certain degree, you know, you're hedging your bets on this company being around the day that you want to recover. You want to recover your wallet, because if what happens is, you know, it is making API calls to their backend to announce the transaction or get a snapshot of the blockchain, and that's the only way that it's going to communicate. You might be in the situation where you have hundreds of thousands of dollars on this thing and you can't get them off of there because the company shut down.
Right. And so I guess that's also why, you know, it's cool if you can use third-party software, right? Like the likes of Sparrow and Spectre and Nunchuck, right, and these other ones. So that way you're not beholden, you're not sort of vendor lock-in, you know, you have to use this hardware wallet with that particular software. That's another angle of it. One other thing, just kind of broadly while we're talking about hardware attacks, as I'm aware, there's different kinds of attacks, right? So one, I guess there's a broad category which people call side channel attacks. And that's, I'm sorry, obviously you're familiar with this, but what are some of the broad categories, right? Is it side channel attacks and just kind of directly trying to, you know, take the device apart and open it? What are some of the different categories here and things to think about there?
Yeah, so I mean, usually, so like this again is where I feel like you know, I can recall my PhD defense standing and having these arguments with the professor standing across from me, because this is completely, you know, conjecture slash opinion, my personal opinion. So I would argue most of the time, if you're talking about side channel attacks, that's kind of a implementation specific thing. So it's going to be, what crypto algorithm am I using? How am I using the key? You know, what kind of countermeasures am I using? A lot of times there was actually patents from essentially, so a lot of the patents around side channel attacks and side channel analysis, they're actually from like roughly 96 to 99 to like 2000. So interestingly enough, people will forget this. That means that all those patents have expired. So there's like no reason, you don't have to pay any sort of crazy licensing to implement this kind of stuff. And actually, I mean, I have to say for some of this stuff, Trezor actually, you know, has a pretty good, the Trezor code base has some good examples of what to do, you know, kind of the pin hardening and how they increment the pin counters and stuff like this. They have a lot of industry best practices implemented in their code. I'll give them a fist bump on that. But the, so essentially I would argue side channel stuff is kind of implementation specific. It is really depends on the implementation. So there you have to have knowledge of what's the implementation, you know, what am I doing? It's also, if you have some idea that there's crypto happening, it might be easier to make some assumptions about what crypto is happening on this device. So let's say, you know, it's using some standard cryptocurrency curve, you know, the curve. Now you can kind of, you know, create an attack around the fact that, you know, that if the, you know, when you plug this device in, if it's doing some form of authentication and it's using this cryptocurrency or this cryptography algorithm, I might be able to build a side channel attack against it. The issue is, it's possible. I would argue it's a little bit tedious. It's kind of, at the same time, it takes a lot of prep. And I'm building up to the point, I've never ever done like a real side channel attack on a real device in practice. Like, I've totally done them for my PhD. I've totally done them, you know, as part of, you know, PhD level courses, and taught them to our grad level students at the university. They would all get to do some side channel attacks. I've never had to do a side channel attack on anything in practice of any device that I've ever looked at. And the kind of the reason for that is the next step up is what's called fault injection attacks. And so there, you again are making assumptions about what kind of code is it executing or what's happening, but you're confident that you can essentially flip certain values that are being read as they're being executed. And that allows you to skip instructions, flip certain values from, you know, let's say you have a value of one, you can turn it into a zero. And so if you just think about how you normally write code with ifs and elses, you can easily end up in a situation where, you know, you're executing this code, but now you fall through. And even though you didn't enter the password correctly, essentially the fact that you did a glitch turned a one into a zero. And so now the code acts as if you entered the password correctly, something along this line. So that's generally the attack, the more kind of the more powerful attack. And I would argue, even if you're talking about opening up chips and going to the transistor level, usually what ends up happening there is you identify where's the data bus, and you are just injecting ones and zeros directly onto, essentially directly into the CPU registers, directly on the data buses as they're flowing there. So it's effectively like you're doing a fault injection attack where you have a 100% success rate because you're directly inside the CPU. So you're flipping values directly, you know, as if you're doing a, you know, an operation on the brain of the of this chip.
I see. Interesting. So it's kind of like, even though occasionally we might see news articles about these kind of crazy side channel attacks where maybe, you know, the way I'm typing onto my keyboard and the different keys make a different sound, and therefore from hearing that, you know, someone can like work out what my passphrase is from the, like what you're saying is in practice, actually it's more about the fault injection style of attack as opposed to side channel attacks where people are like figuring out your typing from the keyboard or the some right. other, you know, some.
Well, other. I mean, so I would say like the question is how likely are you to end up in a scenario where somebody can see you type something in versus how likely are you to, you know, leave your cryptocurrency wallet at the right. I mean, at the airport, like at security in the one of the bins. I mean, I recently left the phone, had to walk back. All that kind of stuff. I mean, just misplace it or evil maid attacks. I mean, they're called that for a reason. I mean, you leave it in your hotel room. I mean, pro tip. I mean, this used to be the thing that I would do for entertainment purposes at cryptocurrency conferences. I would go around and then I would introduce myself and explain all the stuff that I did. And I mean, a lot of people know the talk to this day. So, I mean, I'm always happy. And then I would just ask people next, I would say, do you have your hardware wallet with you? And then you just see people's faces turn pale because you will be absolutely blown away how many people travel with all their crypto on them on a hardware wallet. I mean, it is not, I mean, we talk about best practices. I mean, I know you're one of the advocates for how not to do this, but you will be I mean, you know, 2049 is happening in Dubai right now. I mean, you do not want to know how many billions of dollars are walking around the halls there.
Yeah, I'm very surprised about this kind of thing as well. Like, I've heard of this kind of thing, and I'm just blown away when I hear people do this kind of thing. I mean, maybe they would argue and say, look, I'm a digital nomad, and I don't have a place to leave it or something. I don't know. But it's always been a bit bizarre to me, let's just say. So, I mean, we're talking about these different attacks, as you said, fault injection attacks, at the expensive level, the transistor level. I guess kind of to sort of close off this topic, I guess, do you have any tips for people out there when they are, you know, trying to secure their coins in terms of how they should assess hardware wallets? How should they think about, you know, their hardware security?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons to use a hardware wallet, but you should just be cognizant of like the reasons when it makes sense to use a hardware wallet and when it doesn't make sense to use a hardware wallet. I mean, me personally, we get paid for consulting work in crypto by some wallets. They'll pay us in, you know, token, or they'll pay us in USDT. Unfortunately, I mean, we have yet to get paid in Bitcoin for any audits. I mean, we had this conversation with you as well. So we'll get paid in crypto. I mean, I can't speak for my colleague Josh that does this, but you know, for the most part, I'm trying to pay the bills with this, so I'm just taking that money, converting it to fiat, feeding the family and all that kind of stuff. So I don't really have a use case just from that transaction alone. I don't really have the use case for a hardware wallet because the time of life of the cryptocurrency on any of my, you know, accounts/wallets is minimal. For crypto that I store it. I'm like I don't do any trading. So I'm a long-term hodler, so to say. I would anecdotally say that's a lot of users out there. And so I would encourage you to consider whether you need a hardware wallet at all in that case, because you might just need the, you know, the seed phrase backup, just delete it from whatever device you use it on. Just keep it completely offline. We're advocates of potentially for those kinds of use cases. I mean, people easily without thinking about it will upgrade their phone every year. I mean, instead of giving your last year's iPhone to your family, why not use that as your new, offline smartphone with whatever 1-2 years of security via Apple is worth, just storing in essentially a smartphone app or in a password manager or something like that, or even for all intents and purposes as an offline note of some sort where you don't have an account or anything activated on this thing. You could be storing your passphrase there and be leveraging the security that Apple built into the iPhone for you. But the place where it really does make sense to use a hardware wallet, I mean, so the first one, which I think is like undervalued, is for example, we have some cryptocurrency wallets that we look at where they're, you know, there's a gigantic community around them. People are using them. People are like, I don't know, you get free drinks at the bar at some crypto conference because you have this wallet, because they're sponsoring an event. I mean, obviously get the wallet to be part of the community to be part of that. I'm not saying like crypto wallets don't, or hardware wallets don't have a kind of a niche to fill like that. They're definitely, I mean, they totally do. The other one that's actually that I think if you're doing trading on a day-to-day basis, it makes a lot of sense to have a hardware wallet as well. But just to give you, I mean, like the use cases where it's crazy to me, I know a lot of people are using hardware wallets that I've heard multiple times is, for example, hedge funds trading on Wall Street trading crypto. I mean, I've heard this multiple times. I'm not going to say who I heard it from, but they're up there. Is the process is usually that they have a cryptocurrency wallet and they're essentially, they're coming into the office. They get handed essentially a ledger because that one in that decision-making cycle, that's the one that they want to use. And they get handed a ledger every morning from the IT guy. They go, they know, everyone knows the PIN to every ledger. So it's that issue's solved because the PIN's the same on all of them generally. And then they go connect it to their PC, send all the funds that are there to Coinbase Prime or Kraken or whatever they're using to trade during the day. And then at the end of the day, they move it back. So, I mean, so many issues with that one. I mean, like, I mean, how much do you trust these guys that are, these traders that are coming in and out? How do you actually follow them? I mean, what's the risk of somebody walking out the door with a wallet versus the risk of Coinbase, you know, getting hacked and losing all the funds tomorrow? I would probably come down on the side of Coinbase versus the guy who has the PIN to the ledger and all this kind of stuff. So I think generally though, for the regular, you know, listener slash person in crypto, if they're trading on any sort of regular basis, I totally think it makes sense to have a hardware wallet, especially if you're trading from, you know, your PC and especially, I mean, the integrations have gotten so good where, I mean, essentially you plug in the Trezor, directly connects, you know, you can do the wallet connect stuff potentially. I mean, the wallet connect stuff will also work with the smartphone app on occasion, but I mean, there's so many great integrations where I totally see the added value of a cryptocurrency wallet versus, you know, restoring, walking around with a piece of paper and restoring it every single time. So if you're accessing your crypto on a daily basis, that's when I think a hardware wallet really makes sense. But if you're setting up a wallet once, I mean, it makes sense in the multi-sig example that you said as well, because that's the only real reliable way to do it. But use separate pins, guys. Use separate pins. Don't be like the guy that we had to help. If you end up in a situation where you have, just be cognizant of the fact that the hardware wallet's really only protecting you from the machine that you're connecting to, I guess is how I'd put it. I mean, there's at the end of the day, that's the biggest thing that it's solving for you.
I see, yeah. And so what would you say about, I think one other thing that hardware wallets can help you on though, or a few other things, is sort of the practical elements of actually signing with that while not exposing your keys online. I think that's the other part that, you know, maybe if you only had it written down or if you only had it on, you know, without a device that can actually sign transactions for you, then how are you going to actually sign things, right? Like in an air-gapped or kind of in a secure way?
No, for sure. I mean, but I would argue, I don't know how much you've used, have you've tried any of the wallet connect stuff on a smartphone. I mean, yes, you have two quote-unquote internet-connected devices, but you're essentially, you know, getting push notifications to your smartphone to confirm transactions. I mean, so they solve that for, it's not just hardware wallets that can essentially keep you in a semi, you know, offline environment. I mean, yes, there's an internet connection to send the notification, etc. I mean, the question is, what's the likelihood if you, so for example, I mean, we were talking about, you know, how many networks each of us have before we started recording this and which one we'll be using for the recording. I mean, if you have them on two separate networks, etc., what's the real likelihood that, you know, both of the devices are going to get owned in some way on both of the networks? I mean, so the smartphone is a perfect example. I mean, what's the likelihood that if you have this offline device, you put a SIM card in there just to do one transaction, what's the likelihood that in that moment of time, boom, that's when this device is somehow going to get owned over the network? I would argue it's pretty remote, but I agree. I mean, at the end of the day, you shouldn't be, if you're doing this on a daily basis, if you're dealing with a lot of funds, you should be very cognizant of reducing the amount of time that you have your keys exposed on the same machine that you're using to browse the internet, interact, send money, do all this kind of stuff. There's no question there.
Yeah. One other question on hardware wallets. You know, we've been talking about the different, you know, types of security and so on. Where do you see it going longer term? Like, do you see it, you know, as number goes up, as the security requirements rise, what kinds of things do you foresee coming to the Bitcoin hardware security industry?
I mean, it's difficult to make, like, just to completely guess where everything's going to go. But I have a feeling, you know, with if we're just talking about the crypto economics, I mean, I think there's a lot of demand for hardware wallets. I think as, you know, Bitcoin rises, people want to spend their money on things that they can purchase in Bitcoin. Everyone sells their cryptocurrency wallets for crypto as well. So that's, I mean, they're not going to go away. I mean, I can say, you know, we, I didn't really mention it. I mean, I'm sure we'll have like all the links in the show notes afterwards, but all the audits that we do for Key Labs, I mean, where we do the third party audits for people, I can tell you right now, the bull run right now is probably going to mean that we're going to have work next year when, you know, people have founded a company and started a new wallet, and then they'll come to us next year to have it audited. I mean, because every bull run, we kind of see the delay between, you know, prices hitting an all-time high and then people reaching out. So, I mean, there's definitely room for innovation. But I guess overall, if I'm going to look at the last snapshot, going back to our talk in December 2018 versus today, I mean, realistically, not all that much has changed. I mean, I think the kind of the formula is sort of good enough. The kind of the potentially the only pressure, depending on how widespread it is kind of the, you know, how cognizant and how much do people want to defend themselves from kind of the recovery services that are out there nowadays, and how much pressure there's going to be to kind of protect yourself from, let's say, a quote unquote state actor or something like that. You know, I mean, if at some point, you know, every police department can do this kind of stuff, it might be an issue where you know, people might want to reach a different level of security there.
Yeah, I see. So let's turn now to the backups aspect of it. I know you have a solution here that, I mean, high level, it's using Shamir's secret sharing and NFC right. tags to kind of make it work. But can you just overview this for us?
Yeah, so actually there is a proposal. I mean, so a lot of people listening to this podcast will know Ian Coleman and Eel Coleman's lovely website for testing.
Great
for site, testing yeah. BIP39s and seeing how stuff gets derived, etc. There is actually a proposal floating for a long time doing something called Shamir 39. So it's basically doing Shamir splits, but then converting him back to back to words again. And then so converting the splits, or rather taking a seed phrase, splitting it, but then creating words for the splits, which would let you write down essentially. So if you're doing three splits, you would have three sets of words that you could then write down just using the same kind of dictionary, just so that you could write them down. It's a little bit different from the slip proposal that Trezor uses for
the
their
Shamir
thing. It's a little bit, it's not, so the biggest advantage to the Shamir 39 approach is that it can actually do it on anything. So it could be a password, or it could be a seed phrase, or it could be, you know, a password and a seed phrase, a seed phrase with a password, something like that. I mean, it's essentially a technique for encrypting arbitrary data, whereas the slip one actually is Bitcoin specific, and it also generates completely different addresses if you're using it. So it's a little bit, I mean, it's less kind of applicable to, I mean, I know you're a Bitcoin podcast, but I mean, for us, we try to help people out that do other cryptocurrencies, you know, Ethereum, what have you, as well. I mean, we're impartial in that sense. And so the kind of the proposal is to do it like that. So we set up, I did basically a demo app where you can essentially write your seed backup to a bunch of cards. And where this gets interesting is actually combining it, because you don't actually have to, short term, the kind of proof of concept MVP, which completely works. I mean, the crazy thing is nowadays you can do it with, so the demo I wrote is using Web NFC on the, so which works with Android out of the box. I mean, you can use any Android, Graphene OS, what have you, Android based device to do it. You can turn on airplane mode and do it completely offline. You don't have to be online for it, but you can write essentially the split to three cards and then use the cards to restore them. Where it gets interesting and kind of the direction that I see this going is actually to, so for example, I can say that at Key Labs, or the wallets that we've been auditing at Key Labs, all the wallets that we're currently auditing have NFC integration. So the wallets that will be coming out in 2024, 2025, they're all going to have NFC integration. So they could directly interface to these cards. So now, instead of having essentially a paper backup, you could have a backup to an NFC card, something in a machine readable format where it's easy to backup and restore and do all that kind of stuff. And then it's also interesting because since it's a Shamir split, you could actually do this in a non, you could store this with a third party that you don't have to trust in a non-custodial way. So, I mean, I could send it to Stefan. I could put it on a letter, take an NFC sticker. I could send it to my lawyer or my accountant or something like this and have him use it for safekeeping. Or I could go to essentially have a website or some sort of backup service, and they could store the seed for me, and they would not be able to do anything with it. They wouldn't be able to identify it. They wouldn't be able to identify what is this part of. And you could build a backup service around it. So that's one of the things that we're slowly working on, and we're trying to get, for different parts of it, different aspects of it. We're doing some grants and potentially some equity financing. So
yeah, we'll interesting. Hopefully have the one implication I can think of is it might change the paradigm. Instead of right now the typical, what I'm holding up to the screen here just for the audio listeners is like the typical, writing down your 12 or 24 words. Obviously, this is a test setup, whatever.
It was also empty anyway. For the listeners.
Yeah,
Stefan did not just hold up a full seed.
A real, seed words card, right? But the but it might change the paradigm where maybe for some users, instead of having to write down 12 or 24 words, maybe it's just like buy these cheap NFC tap cards and have three splits and write three splits to them and keep those three split NFC cards in different locations. And you don't have to write it down. So maybe it's like a very slick experience.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the kind of the use case that I have in mind, I mean, specifically where I think it's super interesting is if you think about, I mean, I know I'm going to be, that guy saying about, the under the parts of the world that can't afford a hardware wallet. But I mean, hardware wallets are kind of expensive. I mean, if we're being honest, I mean, there's billions of people that can't afford a hardware wallet. I mean, they, for them, crypto is a big enough hurdle as it is. And so for them, I think the kind of the approach of a smartphone app is more interesting. And then what this is doing is it's essentially giving them a cold storage backup of whatever they have inside their wallet app on their smartphone. It's giving them a way to store it as cold storage. And essentially what you could do is for the wallet apps, and I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we're trying to get to through grants, et cetera, to be able to work on and kind of help people integrate into their wallets. I mean, what you could do is you have a wallet app, and so now you actually store one of the Shamir splits instead of the entire seed phrase. And so every time you want to use it, you have to tap the card for it to be able to restore the full seed phrase and be able to use it. And now from from a app engineering point of view, you can just make sure that, that memory contents gets nuked every 10 or 15 minutes. So you have to tap the card at least once every 15 minutes to be able to restore the full seed phrase for the wallet to operate. And now we're back in the situation where the risk is actually mitigated pretty well. The likelihood of you essentially being owned is somebody has to do it within a pretty limited
time window. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so I mean, this wouldn't obviously, I wouldn't see this as like secure your life savings, that you would normally do. Yeah, but this would be maybe for smaller amounts. it would be very practical to do this kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I would argue. I mean, I was secure. I mean, I do something. I mean, I came up with this idea because I do something similar as this. I mean, I would secure my. I would totally feel comfortable securing my life savings on. On a thing like this. I mean, there's nothing preventing you. I mean, at that point, you've reduced it. I mean, most people. Let's be honest. I mean, most people that have a hardware wallet. I mean. Most people that I know that have a hardware wallet have the seed phrase backup in the same drawer as the hardware wallet. I mean, so what's the incremental benefit of keeping it secure on the hardware wallet if you have the words right next to them? I mean, I even when people ask us, this is like another thing that we've done for a couple of clients, how they come to us and they ask how should they store their crypto. I mean, we tell them, you know, if you're going to use a hardware wallet, put it in the, you know, and you want to keep it in at the bank, do it. Get a safety deposit box. Keep your seed phrase there. I mean, what's the difference? I mean, like the hurdle that you're actually introducing is how do you get to the safety deposit box and bypass all the security? How do you turn it into Ocean's 11 movie, basically, phrased another way?
But even there, like if you're getting really paranoid, like sometimes they drill the safety boxes and, right. You know, or like the state can say, hey, we want to access Dimitri's box at the bank or whatever. So... But I mean, it could make sense if that's one of your multi-sig keys and you've got different keys and, you know, et cetera.
No, absolutely. But I mean, I'm also if you split it, I mean, you could have, you know, in the case that you're trying to avoid some state actor, I mean, maybe you have one at home, one with a family member, and then one in a different country or something like this. And so now they also can't do anything because they might only find the split that you have at home. And then they
right, yeah, you segregate, you put different locations and all of these right. things, yeah. Yeah, but I guess the other big thing for me, though, is this kind of, I like the idea, at least when you're talking about larger amounts, I like the idea of not reconstituting the private key all together in one place because now you're vulnerable in that moment, right? Now, you said, okay, I have some kind of 10 or 15 minute timer or timeout thing on the app, so that way, you know, it's a limited time thing. But I guess, yeah, if you're just talking about larger amounts, or let's say for a business, right? Like for a business or a large exchange, this kind of thing, like they might be dealing with, you know, hundreds of millions or more. At that level, yeah, they probably do need to have like multi-sig and not keep, you know, not reconstitute the seed all in one place and keep it, you know, in a very segregated way.
Yeah, but anyway, just to name an example, I mean, so for multi-sig on ETH, I know this is a Bitcoin podcast, I'll say that again. The most popular solution is actually something called Gnosis Safe that people use. So it's essentially, you know, like for all intents and purposes, it looks like a web app where you connect a wallet and stuff like this. I mean, it supports Ledger and Trezor, and you can use them, and you're basically doing smart contract multi-sig for the Ethereum stuff.
Right.
But the point is, if you're trying to onboard 10 people, I mean, do you really need to purchase 10 wallets, or can some of the less important people that potentially aren't as big a threshold in the kind of split, all of this is kind of implemented as smart contracts in ETH. But what if the less important people just have something like this because they can, you know, you can just go on Amazon, order a bunch of cards, and now these guys have a quote unquote cold storage backup of their signing key. And when you actually need them, you phone them up, say, you know, load this on your phone for 10 minutes and then we'll sign this and then go back.
Ceremony or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting.
So, I mean, if you want to be from a technical point of view, the more accurate description for this is kind of a replacement for, you could argue this is more of a replacement for something like the paper backup or the crypto steal at the end of the day. I mean, at rest, it totally is just a backup of the seed phrase, but the kind of, if you think about how are people going to use this, it gets slightly more interesting in terms of, you know, if you actually, so for example, let's say you have a separate phone. I mean, so you take a separate phone, you completely erase it. You take last year's iPhone that you've been keeping in the drawer just for this day. You completely erase it. No Apple ID that you're entering on this thing or anything at all. You just restore it from scratch, you know, load it, send one transaction. I think that solves the issue for a lot of people. I mean, especially if before you do that, you have to collect them from at one location to be able to restore them. I mean, like you said, at the end of the day, the thing that you're actually achieving is at rest. You're not storing the entire seed phrase reconstituted on a device, which is the kind of the actual issue. Going back to the hardware wallets.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So, so I guess you're looking for support with the backup thing, right? So what can, if people are interested, what's the best way for them to kind of find out more about this or get in touch?
Yeah. So we'll have links below. So the working name for this is a recovery tag. We're working on this. So we're trying to get some grants. To work on this. We want to do Bitcoin as well. The Bitcoin grants are, the process so far has been longer than what some of the other grant organizations that I've gotten in touch with on some of the other blockchains. So I'd be curious to kind of have this as well. I mean, just to give you a couple ideas of where it can go. I mean, in theory, if you don't have to trust the third party, just in theory, I mean, this one isn't fully flushed out, but you could even do an ordinal of one of these seeds and just put it on the blockchain. I mean, if no one knows what this encrypted thing is, I mean, they're not going to be able to recover it. So, I mean, there's stuff like that that you could do in Bitcoin. I know you just started a gigantic discussion on ordinals on this episode, but stuff like that might be better than
retardinals, as I prefer to call them. But I guess theoretically people could do inscriptions, although. Is that really the best place? I don't know.
I think we're going to eventually have the goal is to kind of fund a lot of the open source stuff, for all this to be open source, for there to be native Android and iOS apps that are open source that people can then essentially take the library, integrate it with them. And eventually we'll have a backup server service thing as well. We're probably eventually going to have our own service that we host, that if you want to kind of support us in our project, you can use that. Another non-custodial, multi-sig provider could offer this at a kind of as a lower tier service that doesn't require as much white glove treatment or something like that. So I think there's going to be a lot of innovation. I mean, so if we're coming back to the innovation wallets, I think the innovation is going to be, I think the biggest missing piece where I do see stuff happening is, you know, in multi-sig and kind of how do I actually store my backups? Because at the end of the day, you don't want to end up in the situation that you're looking for a crypto recovery service that's going to take a percentage fee to recover your crypto.
Right. Yeah. And it could make sense, in different contexts where maybe it's not the backup for all of your seeds. Like maybe it's like the backup for one of your out of your multi-sig keys, and this is kind of the one that's split amongst your lawyer and your accountant and someone in your family or whatever. And it's like a recovery sort of in the case that you die or get disabled or something.
Again, for the recovery services stuff, I mean, a lot of the use cases, I mean, ranging from, somebody was in an accident and forgot their, whatever passphrase, seed phrase, PIN, to, someone passed away and now it's on a ledger blue and now they can't get to it. I mean, a lot of the stories are depressing. I mean, people should put more thought on, how to pass their crypto along to their loved ones after they pass away. Sooner rather than later.
All right. Well, I think that's a pretty good spot to finish here. At the end of the day, there's a lot of different stuff we went through today. So around, hardware security and practical, what does it mean? Tips. Dimitri, thanks for joining us and sharing your insights about hardware security.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Stefan.
All right, I hope you enjoyed the show with Dimitri and maybe you learned something about Bitcoin hardware security and where things are at and where things are potentially going in the future. I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure to press like and share it out there with family and friends. That's it for me. I'll see you in the Citadels.